From WKAR Studios at Michigan State University, welcome back to the second half hour of Current State. I'm WKAR Digital News Director Reginald Hardwick, catching you up on what's happening around the Capital Region and the Great Lakes. We start with a new milestone for MSU's College of Human Medicine. A new research center in Grand Rapids opened this week, and as WKAR's Scott Pohl reports, many of the doctors will be focused on autism in children.
Early detection and treatment is the best path to reducing the severity of autism in children. The opening of the new MSU College of Human Medicine research facility in Grand Rapids this week will include an expansion of efforts to find markers that could result in earlier detection. I talked with Dr. Keith English, chairman of the college's Department of Pediatrics and Human Development. He says the Grand Rapids expansion has made it possible to recruit three new developmental neuroscientists who will look for these markers.
This will just be a basic science research facility. However, it will include strong and growing partnerships with our colleagues at Helen DeVos Children's Hospital in pediatric neurology and pediatric behavioral health, developmental behavioral pediatrics, child psychiatry, etc. There, we will be collaborating with doctors and researchers there at Helen DeVos as part of a team effort to better understand autism and intervene earlier.
How do we detect autism earlier?
Well, that's a great question, and really it's the most important challenge in autism today. Currently, we really can only make the diagnosis once a child develops these features that fit the diagnosis, and that's frustrating for parents, families, and children and doctors, because by the time that occurs, we're worried that we've missed our best chance to intervene. So to intervene earlier, we have to understand the causes of autism and markers of autism. That might be a blood test. It might be a genetic test. It might be an EEG finding. It might be neuroimaging. So all of these different areas are being studied, and we're getting good insight now into how we identify a child before they develop the features of autism so that we can intervene earlier.
How might that intervention manifest itself? What can we do with information, say, prenatal or in the first year or two of life?
Mainly what we can do today is use the same behavioral interventions that we've already found effective in older children. More and more of these interventions are being done in children as young as a year of age, but we have to know which children would benefit in order to do that. In the longer term, the hope is we will actually develop new or targeted treatments for children with autism caused by specific problems, because every child with autism is not the same. It is a spectrum disorder, as everyone knows. There are grades of severity, and even children who appear pretty similar might have a different cause for the autism and might respond to a different treatment. So really our long-term goal is to bring precision medicine to children with autism and to other disorders so that we identify early and we intervene more specifically than we can today.
You've made me wonder about children who will never develop autism and how they might be affected by using some of these interventions. Is there's no risk in exposing all children to interventions that might prove helpful?
You know, that's a very good question, and I would agree in part, but not completely. The part I would agree with is that some of the things that we know are good for normal brain development, we need to do for every child in America. They need a safe environment. They need good nutrition, and they need good schools. Preschool is very helpful. We know that. But in terms of specific interventions, some of these may even include medications in the future. In those cases, we don't want to give a medication to a child who would not benefit from it because they might be the child to get a rare side effect. So some of the interventions, absolutely, we should do for everybody. Others might actually cause harm if we give it to the wrong child.
Dr. Keith English, thank you.
Thank you very much.
For WKAR News, this is Scott Pohl.
The Vietnam War is an 18-hour documentary that began last Sunday on WKAR TV 23 and continues this Sunday. It examines everything from how Vietnam was colonized by the French to the bloody battles between North Vietnamese forces and the U.S. military, and the commands that came from Washington. Michigan State University had a close relationship with the South Vietnamese government during the 1950s, and you're about to hear about an extensive collection of material on that topic in a moment. But first, let's hear from co-directors Ken Burns and Lynn Novick about why they made this documentary, The Vietnam War.
I grew up in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Ann Arbor, Michigan in March of 1965 had one of the first teach-ins about the war. It began in the anthropology department, and my father was in the anthropology department. And so our family was being pulled in a lot of directions, just as my country was.
I was born in 1962. As I was growing up, it was sort of in the background, this big, important, and not good thing was happening. And I could sense that all the adults were concerned talking about it, but I really didn't understand what was going on. And as I got older, I began to sort of ask myself, what is this thing that was happening? Sort of overshadowing my whole childhood, basically.
We've spent a decade trying to put our arms around a hugely complicated and controversial event in American history. We didn't have an agenda. We didn't have an axe to grind. We had a story that we wanted to tell.
We think we're making this film at the perfect time because the people who lived through it are very much alive, very much aware of what they went through, and at an age where they want to talk about it.
We hope that we might be some agency of healing for the soldiers who lived through it, to take whatever slight burden off the already immense burden they still carry.
I think we have tried to make a film that everyone will be interested in watching, whether you're 18 or 80, whether you're a man or a woman, whether your politics are left or right. I think we want the film to inspire a new conversation about the war, but also the film is asking a lot of questions, and we don't pretend to answer them. We just want to throw those questions out for our country to think about again.
Joining us now is Dr. Charles Keith, an historian on modern Vietnam and author of the book Catholic Vietnam, A Church from Empire to Nation, and Cynthia Gehring, director of the MSU Archives. Welcome.
Thank you.
Hello.
So Dr. Keith, MSU Assistant Professor Wesley Fischel was a good friend of South Vietnamese President Diem. What was their relationship and how did that start?
Well, they met in Japan in the early 1950s. Dr. Fischel was an expert. He was a political scientist and an expert on East Asia. He was doing research, and Diem was over in Japan, actually, basically looking for political support for his cause, his kind of non-communist cause in the war against the French. So they met there and hit it off. Fischel was a pretty committed anti-communist, and he really liked what he saw from Diem. So he invited him to the United States, and Diem spent some time during his travels in East Lansing in 1953. Later on, when the State Department was looking for some technical assistance programs in South Vietnam, MSU was an obvious choice given that relationship.
And at some point, Dr. Fischel actually even moved to Vietnam.
That's right. He moved to Vietnam. He was there for most of the second half of the 1950s, back and forth. He was the director of the fairly large program of technical assistance that MSU headed at that time.
At some point, the South Vietnamese president was overthrown and assassinated. What was the response from Dr. Fischel then, and where was he at that time?
My sense was he was pretty shocked, like many Americans who were deeply involved in Vietnam. The technical assistance programs had actually ended a couple years before, partly due to a kind of growing tensions between Diem and Fischel over the way that Diem was running the government. So Fischel came back more or less permanently in 61 or 62. But my sense from, at least from some of the materials in the archives, which we'll talk about in a second, is that he was nevertheless really still shocked, and he'd known this person for a long time and still believed that despite all of his shortcomings, that he was the best fit for the job of leading South Vietnam.
Let's talk about the archives, because you can actually see pictures of Professor Fischel, you know, arriving in Vietnam with his family.
Yes. Coming off the plane, being greeted by dignitaries in Vietnam. It is a fascinating collection that really documents the ins and outs of the whole time period where Michigan State was providing the technical assistance that Charles talks about.
Among the 80,000 documents, what other things are in there?
Well, 80,000 documents are really highlights, selections from the collection. There are 100 cubic feet of records. This is the think of the time period in the 50s and early 60s where automation was starting to happen. We were starting to use computers, but the majority of the forms, the photographs, the documentation and records of the whole enterprise were all paper-based. So we have the collections from not only from the international studies and programs that oversaw the technical, the Vietnam Advisory Group under MSU, but also the individual professors that participated, from Dr. Ralph Turner, a noted professor in criminal justice and forensics. He helped lead the technical advisory for the police in Vietnam. And so what we have is a representation of both the MSU's records from the administrative standpoint, as well as the records from the professors and the kind of on-the-ground work that they were doing. It's a really fascinating collection, and one that we wouldn't have nowadays with the digital environment. It would be hard to duplicate something like this.
Why was Michigan State University so involved in South Vietnam?
Well, it really started thanks to this relationship between Ngo Dinh Diem and Wesley Fischel. John Hanna also had strong connections. John Hanna was president of the university at the time, strong connections to the Eisenhower administration. Michigan State was also at the time rapidly expanding its sort of realms of expertise, starting to look like what it looks like now, which is a university where you can study pretty much everything. So it fit the bill of one of these kind of growing public universities that had experts not only in the sort of traditional university fields, but much more a range of applied and more technical disciplines. And then, the personal connection really mattered. Ngo Dinh Diem was under a lot of political pressure at the time. He had a lot of enemies, and he really wanted people he could trust to work with. So the relationship with Fischel counted for a whole lot.
Now, not everything was copacetic, seeing that there was Ramparts magazine, which is part of the collection, had an article that charged that MSU was acting for a front for the CIA. I mean, were there protests here at MSU? Were there people who were unhappy with the university's involvement?
Curiously, not really during the programs. And what really changed was the political climate, of course. America's growing intervention in Vietnam started to raise more and more opposition. And so by the time that article came out, there was a lot of opposition to America's involvement in Vietnam. And as a result, a whole lot of protest surrounding something that had already ended, right? The CIA revelations were certainly something that were quite controversial on campus. There were some pretty large, intense public events here, press conferences with Hanna and Fischel facing a lot of hostile questions. There were even some, the issue even came up at the state legislature. So it was quite controversial at the time. And it's, I think, still remembered as, it's still the best known aspect, I would say, of the history of the programs.
What is the most interesting thing to you that's in the archives?
Oh, that's a very good question. How could I possibly choose? It's all so fascinating. I think there are a lot of human stories in the archives. That's always, in general, the most fascinating thing for me, to be able to have a glimpse into the experiences and perspectives of individuals. It's such a wonderful way to shed light on bigger historical events and questions. So whether it's correspondence between Wesley Fischel and Ngo Dinh Diem, which shows this sort of more intimate kind of friendship that the two of them had at this important historical moment. Those are really fascinating letters. My students really enjoy reading those. There are also sort of wonderful glimpses into some of the figures behind the first government of South Vietnam, which remains a pretty poorly understood country and government. And I think contrary to what we often hear, this was a government that a lot of people really believed in and had high hopes for. And you see some of that kind of energy and ambition and hope that was really characteristic of the 50s before the war really set in and things got much worse.
I'd have to say that I'm not a scholar of Vietnam. I think there are some really interesting historical material about Vietnam, the country, and how the agriculture and how people lived, and really good statistical quantitative information. But what really excites me as a person, I think, is more the images, the moving images, and the ties to average people. So recently, 2 years ago, we had a family come in that was looking for material on their grandmother who had worked at MSU, and it turned out she was a librarian who had gone to Vietnam in the 50s and worked as part of this project as a librarian. And there was really fascinating information in the collection.
So Cynthia, where can people find the archives and what will they see once they get there?
We had a National Endowment for the Humanities grant started in 2012. Charles Keith was one of our primary investigators, as well as myself and the team from Matrix, our Digital Humanities Center. And in it, we proposed to digitize as much of this collection as we could and provide historical context and some search interfaces that are unique, a timeline, a geographical map where you can actually search by locations, which is a very interesting search interface in that the region has changed, the boundaries and the names of the cities have changed so much over the years. The site itself is vietnamproject.archives.msu.edu, and in it you'll find 80,000 documents, photographs, some audio and film.
What drew you to study Vietnam?
Well, growing up, it was kind of hard to escape the aftermath of the war. I grew up in the 1980s, and the sort of the legacies and the wounds of the war were still very fresh. And so it was just always sort of present. I guess that's what led me to take my first trip there, which I did just as a tourist when I was in my 20s. And going there, I realized I was really fascinated by the place, and I knew I wanted to do advanced study in history, so I decided to study Vietnam.
Dr. Charles Keith, historian on modern Vietnam and author of the book Catholic Vietnam, A Church from Empire to Nation, and Cynthia Gearing, director of the MSU Archives, thank you for joining me.
Thank you.
For WKAR News, I'm Kevin Lavery. Dozens of Michigan National Guard troops welcomed a Vietnam veteran and Medal of Honor recipient today at a ceremony in Lansing. James McLuhan grew up in South Haven and was drafted in 1968. The next year, the Army medic was in Tam Ky, Vietnam, where he saved the lives of 10 soldiers over a 48-hour period of intense combat in which he himself was wounded. He was awarded the Medal of Honor in July by President Trump. McLuhan says he's trying to change the image of the Vietnam veteran.
We are the sons of the World War II veterans. You know, we fought our war and we came home. We didn't say anything about what we had experienced, but the Vietnam veteran, no one spoke up for him, and he really did the same job his father did, only in a kind of a controversial war.
McLuhan says he considers himself just a caretaker of the Medal of Honor. Kevin Lavery, WKAR News. We don't need to escalate. War is not the answer, for only love can conquer hate. You know we've got to find a way to bring some love here today. Oh. Picket lines and picket signs, don't punish me with brutality. Talk to me so you can see. Oh, what's going on? What's going on? What's going on? What's going on? Yeah, what's going on? What's going on? Oh, what's going on? What's going on?
Last year, 72 dams across the U.S. were demolished. Most dam removals are part of an effort to restore rivers and the animals that live there. But when a dam across the St. Regis River in upstate New York was removed late last year, the Mohawk people that live there saw it as an opportunity to reclaim the land and use it to express their culture and heritage. Our reporting partners at Great Lakes today bring us stories from our neighboring states. Veronica Volk reports.
Akwesasne is a large swath of land that straddles the U.S.-Canadian border and sits the meeting point of three rivers, the St. Lawrence, the St. Regis, and the Raquette. It's the Mohawk name for both the region and the people who live there. The territory is sprawling and green in the summer, with pockets of woods broken up by clusters of homes and shops. But a defining feature of the land is the water that runs through it.
The rivers were our main mode of transportation in the past, and so this is like a hub.
Sue Hearn is program coordinator for the museum at the Akwesasne Cultural Center. She says the water also provided fishing and recreation, but years of industrial development and pollution has degraded the waters. General Motors had a plant next to the reservation on the St. Lawrence, and two metal companies also built factories on the river. People were advised not to swim in the area, and limits were put on eating fish caught there.
It really cut us off from that part of who we were.
Pollution wasn't the only factor. In the 1920s, the Hogansburg Hydroelectric Dam was built, creating a 12-foot-high concrete barrier across the St. Regis River. The dam disrupted the migration of sturgeon and salmon to their native spawning beds, which is why Tony David says it had to go.
I feel like I'm exactly where I'm supposed to be. I mean, I was put here to pull this dam out.
David is the Water Resources Program Manager for the St. Regis Mohawk Tribe Environment Division. When the dam's license came up for renewal, he and his team proposed demolishing it, and the dam was taken down late last year. It's all part of a broader plan to improve water quality.
The dam removal was just the first step. We're looking at years of monitoring and recovery and restoration.
Many of the dam removal projects across the U.S. have a common goal, to restore rivers. But the dam demolition in Akwesasne also serves another purpose. The tribe now hopes to reclaim this space in a way that celebrates Akwesasne culture. The stone-faced building that used to house the dam's machinery now sits vacant. But Gail McDonald has big plans for it. She's the tribe's heritage complex project developer.
It's got beautiful original doors on there, and a lot of the windows are the sites that could be some beautiful windows, you know, you can envision that really incorporating a lot of our cultural symbols and meanings and colors.
McDonald and her team want to turn the building and the small plot of land it sits on into an art park, part gallery to showcase local paintings, sculpture, pottery, baskets, but also a space for performance, demonstration, and ceremony, maybe even a cafe that serves local foods.
It's not only just the artistic part of it, but the tourism is also sharing our knowledge and sharing who we are as a people in a very positive way.
McDonald says their main obstacle for the project is funding, but she's hopeful they can reclaim the space. People have already begun to reuse the site. Just across the river, two men wade into the water, knee-deep, with fishing poles and bait buckets. For Great Lakes Today, I'm Veronica Volk in Akwesasne.
Sweet Mother Michigan, Father Superior, coming down from Mackinac and Sault Ste. Marie. Blue water Huron, flow down to Lake Erie, fall to Ontario, run on out to sea.
An impressive fundraiser that will generate more than $1 million for Parkinson's disease research at MSU is set for this weekend in the Kellogg Center. WKAR contributor Russ White with MSU Today explains.
The fundraiser is titled Gibby and Friends versus Parkey. Gibby is MSU's own Kirk Gibson, who was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease in 2015 and in 2016 made a decision to go public with his journey.
So now what? Do you go public with it? Do you go reclusive with it? I thought that over. That was a real easy decision for me to go public with it because, you know, I have mentors in my life, and if you can make a difference, you must make a difference. And I thought that by me coming out public and getting involved and trying to find ways for people to realize they might have Parkinson's, ways to who to go to see if they have it, the different therapies and ways to address it, and ultimately find a cure. That was the way I was going to go, and it wasn't going to be an individual thing. It never has been for me. I was going to turn to my teammates and attack it the best way we know is together.
Gibson says working towards a cure is in some ways a numbers game.
The more people we get involved, the better. We need to get the good word out there. We need to find out people who want to be involved, and then, you know, ultimately, we want to get people who would normally not get together to get together and share their information and be innovative in ways to attack Parkinson's disease.
Gibby is happy to use his notoriety to help shine a light on Parkinson's, and he doesn't care who gets the credit for a cure.
You know, I'm doing this because it's my obligation to give back. I believe in that 100%. You know, we just want to beat this somehow, and where nobody cares who gets the credit. We're not looking for credit. We're just looking for results and someday find a cure for this disease.
Spartans athletic director Mark Hollis believes Gibby's fight against Parkinson's is typical Kirk Gibson.
Stepping into the batter's box in 84 with the Tigers and 88 with the Dodgers and watching and knowing where I was at during those moments in time, he stood in the batter's box and really became an icon as an individual as he was pulling a team and cities to a positive place. And that's what Gibby's doing once again is he's stepping into the batter's box and he's pulling an effort forward that's going to impact so many people beyond himself. And once again, I'm indebted with great respect for him for that.
Spartan Athletics is honoring Gibby at the game tomorrow as well because he'll enter the College Football Hall of Fame this December. Kirk Gibson was a talented All-American receiver at MSU long before he hit two of the most famous home runs in World Series history.
He swings as a long drive to right.
It was his speed that Gibson and many fans recall from his Spartan football days.
I have more people, they say, you know, they always come up and they say, you know what play they remember of my whole career? They remember when, I think it was Steve Smith was going on an end run. He got hit. He fumbled in the arms of a DB from Minnesota. I was over on the other side of the field. He took it and was running a touchdown back. He looked like he was gone, and I ran him down. People tell me that's their favorite thing. And you know what? It's my favorite as well.
Visit KirkGibsonFoundation.org for more. I'm Russ White for WKAR News.
Thank you for joining us for this weekend's Current State. And a reminder, if you click on the Current State story on WKAR.org, you will see music videos that go with many of the songs we used in our breaks today. WKAR's station manager is Peter Worf. Our general manager is Susie Elkins. And I'm Reginald Hardwick, WKAR's digital news director. Have a great weekend.